This is the Medic Cast, February 9th, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medic Cast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis!
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. This is episode 155. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show. If you're a brand new listener, I want to welcome you to head over to the Medic Cast website after you've listened to the show and check out all of the great resources you'll find there, including especially links to everything we talk about in this particular episode. It's important for you to make sure you follow up on that information because, heck, I don't know what your protocols are. I don't know what your instructor guidelines are, and you need to follow what your medical director is telling you to do and not what I tell you to do. So I'll provide you some general medical review information here, but it's your job to follow up on the resources I provide, get more in-depth information, and refer back to your own protocols. Of course, for all of you long-term listeners, welcome to the show. I would also like to encourage you to continue with your great emails, sending me links to news items, keeping me up to date on what's going on in your service, and especially some of the great messages I've gotten back recently from the many of you who've been listening to the show, using it to help you prepare for your classes and your National Registry Test. A bunch of you sent me emails recently about passing National Registry Tests, both the ALS and BLS versions, and I just want to thank you for doing that. It really makes me feel good and makes it the reason I do this show, I guess. So thanks for that and keep them coming. So if you've got a testing time coming up, let me know and let me know how you do. Speaking of letting me know how you do and keeping in touch, if you don't get a response back from me right away, and I do respond to every email, but sometimes it takes me a couple of days, you can always head over and sign up and ask your question in the MedicCast forums. You know, this is a community effort here, and there's a lot of great opportunities for people to answer your questions and you to answer their questions all over at the MedicCast forums, forums.mediccast.com. We have a continuing discussion over there on EMS humor, which goes well with this month's MedicCast Live coming up later this week. Just a lot of good things going on over there, and it gives you an opportunity to help somebody else in the field who maybe needs to learn from your experiences. Let's jump on into some emails I picked up this week. First off, an email in from our pal Irk from the IrkPod podcast, and also a volunteer firefighter and involved in fire dispatch down in New South Wales, Australia. He wanted to send me an update. There's been some really massive wildfires in the state of Victoria in Australia. He was writing this email Sunday night, which actually is like Sunday morning here. We are looking at 65 confirmed dead, 650 homes lost, and surrounding states sending in extra fire crews and paramedics. Also, a good friend of the show, Orange Tim. Tim's a burn nurse. His unit has been activated to go there and provide burn assistance. So we just want to keep everybody in that region in our thoughts and prayers, and hope that the providers and responders return home safely and without any further loss of life and reduced loss of property, if possible. It's difficult when Mother Nature decides to prove who's boss, and unfortunately, people get caught in the way. So hopefully the responders there can help provide the assistance to the communities that is needed. I know Rick Rosati will probably be commenting on this as well. I got another email in from listener Mike. Mike had followed up on a link I sent out to the email list last week to ask for some assistance with some stuff, answering some questions about the show and what you'd like to see here. And in exchange for that, I offered some pretty nice extras, including a PDF on test and study stress And when I did that, apparently Mike lost the link to the second thing I offered, which was a special sneak peek offer to take a look behind the scenes at Medicast Extra. So he sent me an email and wanted to know if I would give him that link again. And so I actually, Mike, you're not alone. A lot of people were having trouble because I just got a great response. And so kind of overloaded the servers, I think, when you were on there. I sent Mike the link and everybody else the link. But I wanted to urge the rest of you. I don't want anybody to miss out on these opportunities. So if you're interested in helping out, answering a brief survey, I mean brief, like three-question survey, I've offered some little extra tidbits, some specials there for you for helping me out. And so to get that, you need to sign up for the email newsletter. So I'll tell you what, I'll hold off and I'll send out that email again midweek, say around Tuesday or Wednesday. So if you're signed up in the newsletter by then, you'll get that link. And if you miss getting in there, if you can't get online between now and then, send me an email and I'll send you the link directly to the survey if you want. So, Mike, thanks for getting back in touch with me, and thanks for keeping in touch, and good luck with your studies. For those of you who don't know how to sign up for the email, go to medicast.com, and you'll see a fill-in box right there on the front page to fill out for all of the email newsletters for my shows. So you can check that out and fill those out as you see fit and get signed up for the newsletters for the Medicast programs, including the Nursing Show newsletter there. Finally, I got an email in from a listener, Renee. Renee is a longtime listener to the show and checks out the Medicast Live as well. She also works with a company that does standby BLS services for major events, things like triathlons, mountain biking, marathons, things like that. And when she does that, she works with this company and they put BLS units in the field. They don't just sit there and wait in case something happens. They're actually actively involved in the events. They set up stations along the way to provide services to the organizers, the contestants, and the public that is there. But what they don't do is transport patients. They come in the unit and they come in and they handle the event, but the local ambulance services are called in to handle transports. One of her problems is that when they're on a standby, she finds that a lot of the ambulance and fire services that come in tend to be a little abrupt with the standby EMS crews, not really giving them the respect that they maybe deserve, not giving them the time of day in some cases. And she's very frustrated with that. And I can understand that. You know, if you have a uniformed provider in a location that is coming in and working an event in your community, one of the things they're doing is coming in and making it so you don't have to work mandatory extra overtime, or that your organization, if it's a volunteer area, has to come up with standby crews. So these events provide their own standby crews. And so it saves you from a day of being there. Plus, they provide additional services that you may not be prepared to provide. When they have a patient that they've already handled initial care for and they're handing over care, you should give them the respect that you expect when you hand over care to a nurse at the hospital. And I know we don't always get that response. Sometimes the nurses just blow us off and send us on our way and start from scratch, but that doesn't make it right. So when you have a uniform provider in the field that you are taking transfer from, you should be listening, respecting what they've done, asking them appropriate questions about their interventions and their procedures that they've put in place, and then take over care for the patient. This is just common courtesy, and I'm shocked, kind of, Renee, that you run into a problem with the agencies that are in your region. And I would just say that hopefully this will not happen in the future. One of the things I suggested to Renee was that she make sure that she does some pre-planning. If she knows she's going into a community for an event, she should contact the agencies in that area. Let them know, hey, we're going to be in the region. Here's our qualifications. Here's what we will be providing on the scene. And this is what we'll be expecting when we call for you, and we'll have transport expectations, obviously, but we'll be able to at least have initial assessment and things done and be able to hand over care professionally to you. And we just wanted to let you know and make your units aware that we're there and that we can expedite the transfer if we can get them to handle things appropriately from the other side. So, Renee, thanks very much for that email, and hopefully everybody out there is taking this information and remembering it when there's a standby organization working in their region. I want to lead off the news stories with a tragic story coming out of Cape Vincent, New York, about a volunteer EMT who had responded to a call for medical assistance there and was assisting paramedics on the scene with a patient, when apparently that patient ran into his own bedroom. They knew that there were weapons in the house for whatever reason. They heard what they thought was the sound of a weapon being cocked or something, and then they began to try to get out of the house. Unfortunately, the EMT, the volunteer EMT by the name of Mark Davis, no relation to me, but still a tragedy, was killed after the suspect fired two shots at them as they retreated from the house. It's really a shame, and it just calls to mind that we really need to be careful. I know that we worry about abandoning a patient. We blow off that there's real danger in some cases. I know that accidents and tragedies can happen to anybody anywhere. Heck, we all know that, right? But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to be extra careful. You know, if there's a chance that there is a firearm in a home, or that there is a patient who is not acting appropriately, and you're in fear, you really need to either back out or at very least call for assistance and get the heck out of there until police arrive. This is sad, and our thoughts and prayers go out to the family and colleagues of this EMT and provider. The police have caught the gentleman involved in the shooting and have charged him, but it still doesn't do anything to bring back the life of this young man. Let's move from this story of scene safety issues and violence to a story I picked up in Australia. Australia ambulance officers, as I've been reporting for some time here in some areas, are really dealing with a lot of issues with violence directed towards them by gangs of youths in some regions where they respond. And this seemed to have happened again. The ambulance officers came in to help out with the shooting of a 17-year-old. And when they got there, about 20 young people ran at the ambulance, banged on the doors and the sides of the ambulance while the providers were inside. The teen was shot in the leg, and they were trying to attempt to treat him at the time. The patient and some of the crowd were under the influence of alcohol, drugs, or both. No surprises there, right? But it's important for us to make sure that we just survey the scene and know the regions in which we're working. So for a lot of older providers, we know the areas where we keep our radar up a little bit higher and we are extra vigilant and extra alert. But for newer providers especially, sometimes you can become too relaxed at a scene and you lose that sense of scene awareness. So really take these two stories to heart in the beginning of this episode. You know, I end every episode of this show with the same words: scene safety, BSI. That scene safety and body substance isolation are universal precautions. The reason I do that is because I want you to be thinking about your own personal safety at all times. Heck, we've got an EMT and paramedic shortage. If for no other reason, we don't have enough of us to spare to injuries and death from not being extra vigilant and careful on the scene. So if you want to even be just that morbid about it, you need to do this so that we don't have to go out and train somebody else. I know, that's awful. We'll talk more about that at the EMS humor session in a couple of days. In the meantime, stay safe, be aware of your scene, be aware of your areas, trouble zones, and take care of yourselves. Moving on to a story I picked up over at emsresponder.com, there is finally a National Transportation Safety Board hearing that is talking about the results and looking for more answers on the recent perceived increase of fatal helicopter medevac crashes. And they looked at some of the statistics involved. The rate of fatalities per 100,000 air ambulance employees over the last 10 years exceeds dangerous professions that we commonly think of, such as logging or, you know, the dangerous catch, right? Deep sea fishing. It's more dangerous to ride an air ambulance. Also, there are relatively few patients, according to this article, that die when you compare them to the numbers. However, that is probably, in my estimation, because they are not transporting patients all the time. You know, the helicopter's in the air without a patient probably more often than it's in the air with a patient. So it total flying time, probably less patients on board during possible crashes. Of course, the crew's on board, and those fatalities are counted as well. So it's important for us to keep these things in mind and think as ground providers, if you're a ground provider, about using aeromedical resources and what the best opportunities for your patient are. And I'm not saying don't use medevac. You need to use the resources you have that best support your patient. But if you're in a position where you sit there and find yourself thinking, well, I could medevac this patient out and avoid an hour-long drive to the hospital and an hour-long drive back, or I could drive this patient to the hospital. And if that's what you're thinking, then it doesn't have to do with the patient care. It has to do with your care, and you need to get in there and drive. That's just the way it is. Hopefully, we'll have some better national standards come down to talk about some of the issues. I know this is going to be an ongoing discussion, and I expect to hear more about it when we come up to the conventions here, both the EMS Today, and also the other conventions that'll be coming up. Finally, I'll wrap up the news looking at a story that came out over at medicinenet.com, and this is a look at how important it is to understand some of the treatments available in your region and understanding that the importance of rapid assessment and treatment of your patients when there are particular kinds of emergencies. Now, this particular story looks at stroke emergencies, and we've covered that and talked about that here before. If you're in class, you've probably talked about the importance that, you know, the old adage about heart patients, time is muscle, is also true for stroke patients. Time is brain power. Time is disability in all effects. Stroke is the number one cause of disability for patients. And so patients who have a stroke need to get rapid treatment, understanding assessments by the providers in the field, and then ascertaining which is the best facility to take them to get them the best treatment possible as rapidly as possible. For patients especially who have a history of TIA, transient ischemic attack, there's an increased risk for patients to suffer another stroke or a minor stroke later on, soon after the occurrence of that TIA. So even if they've had signs and symptoms of a stroke and they're thinking about refusing because it's cleared up on its own, which is what happens in a TIA, these patients still need to go to the hospital and be assessed and probably have some form of blood thinners put in place to make sure that we try to break up any clots before they happen, since they're at increased risk for additional strokes. That needs to happen at the hospital. They should go and get checked out. So this study looked at a lot of different things about recent risk factors for recurrent strokes, and also the risk factors for a fatal or disabling stroke after the fact. So you can read the study and the links in the show notes about this, but we need to keep in mind that all our patients need to be assessed carefully, rapidly, and then we need to move them to the appropriate facility as rapidly as possible, especially for things like strokes and heart attacks, where we can get them to the definitive care they need and clear up that stroke. I mean, people who get rapid treatment with thrombolytics, with drugs that are going to break up that clot, can have a full or nearly full recovery from a stroke if we can get them to the hospital rapidly after that stroke occurs. Let's move on to the end of this week's tip of the week, and we'll be talking again with Lisa Booz. We'll be talking about seizures induced by certain medications, not necessarily drugs, illegal drugs, but Also, legal medications the patients may have inadvertently taken too much of, or maybe their doses have been needing to be adjusted, and that has the levels have built up in their body because of that. In any case, we are going to look at this and listen to what Lisa has to say, and here it goes. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm here again with another episode of the segment we like to call Tox Tidbits with Lisa Booz from Maryland Poison Control. And Lisa, what do you have for us this month?
Well, Jamie, seizures. Seizures are a common reason for calls to 911, a common reason for visits to the hospital, and sometimes they're drug-induced. So what I'd like to do is go over some of the common drugs that can cause seizures.
Great.
Now, first, though, what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about seizures in general. It's estimated that as many as 1 in 10 people will have at least one seizure in their lifetime. There are a wide range of presentations, from no loss of consciousness or cognitive impairment to a complete loss of consciousness. Most patients do have just one seizure, usually lasts less than 2 to 3 minutes, but others do have multiple or prolonged seizures that can progress to status epilepticus and can be fatal. It's often unclear what's causing the seizure. It could be that the patient's epileptic, or there could be a physiologic cause like syncope or migraines, transient ischemic attacks, hypoglycemia, benzodiazepine withdrawal, and one of the most common causes of seizures is ethanol withdrawal. Still others are psychogenic in nature, and then again, a number of patients present with seizures that are actually drug-induced. It's been estimated that more than 6% of new-onset seizures are drug-related, and that up to 9% of cases of status presenting to emergency departments are from drug toxicity. Seizures can follow the therapeutic use of drugs, the recreational use of drugs, and also overdoses of drugs. So it's important for all health professionals really to recognize what drugs are commonly associated with seizures in order to optimize the treatment and to diagnose the patient. So let's start with a drug that poison centers find is the most common cause of drug-induced seizures, at least as far as calls to poison centers, and that's a drug called bupropion. Bupropion is commonly known as Wellbutrin, which is an antidepressant. It's also marketed as Zyban, that's used for smoking cessation. Overdoses as well as high therapeutic doses have caused seizures. The seizures usually occur within 6 hours after an overdose, but there are delayed-release or sustained-release products, for example, Wellbutrin SR and Wellbutrin XL. And with those products, the seizures can be delayed for as long as 18 to 24 hours after the ingestion. So these patients, particularly with the sustained-release products, do require admission to be observed for seizures later on. If a patient has seized, there's also a good chance that he'll seize again. Poison centers also hear about many cases of seizures following overdoses of tramadol. Tramadol is an opioid analgesic. It's commonly known as Ultram or Ultracet. Ultracet is tramadol in combination with acetaminophen. Like bupropion, seizures have occurred both in overdoses and also with therapeutic dosing. The seizures are usually single, they're usually brief, they're usually self-limiting, and they usually occur within 4 hours of the ingestion, although there are cases where they've been delayed for 10 or more hours after the ingestion. Another group of drugs that can cause seizures are the tricyclic antidepressants. And in overdoses, they can cause seizures usually within 2 hours of the ingestion. Most EMS providers and other healthcare professionals are aware that tricyclic antidepressants cause severe cardiac toxicity. You know, that's the thing that we hear about the most with tricyclic antidepressants. But they also can cause seizures. And an interesting fact is that the QRS widening that often occurs with these overdoses can actually predict the onset of seizures. People who have a QRS widening or QRS interval greater than 100 milliseconds have an up to a 34% chance of developing seizures. So we can use that to sort of predict that, you know, maybe that patient later on is going to develop seizures. On the other hand, patients who have seizures are likely to develop other types of clinical effects like acidosis that can precipitate other effects such as hypotension and worsening cardiovascular toxicity. So a key to the treatment of tricyclic antidepressant overdoses is to give sodium bicarbonate to correct the acidosis that might have resulted from the seizures. Venlafaxine, that's known as Effexor, the brand name is Effexor, is a fairly new antidepressant, newer at least than the tricyclic antidepressants, and it's a serotonin and a norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. It doesn't produce seizures very commonly, but it has been known to cause seizures in therapeutic as well as in overdoses. Stimulants such as caffeine, amphetamines like methamphetamine and ecstasy, and especially cocaine, can cause seizures by stimulating the sympathetic nervous system. Seizures are usually brief. They're usually self-limiting, but they can be prolonged. Usually that occurs if there are other complications such as head injury, intracranial hemorrhage, or hyperthermia. All of these are complications that we commonly see with stimulant overdoses. Another drug that commonly causes seizures in high doses is isoniazid, and a lot of the listeners might not be that familiar with this drug, but it's a common drug that's used to treat tuberculosis. In acute or chronic toxic doses, it reduces pyridoxine levels in the body, and it interferes with the metabolism of a substance called GABA. GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, and when you drop your GABA levels, you increase the susceptibility to seizures. Isoniazid can also occasionally cause seizures in therapeutic doses in patients who are predisposed. In other words, patients who have epilepsy, patients who might have pyridoxine deficiency. Isoniazid-induced seizures can be sudden, they can be prolonged, they can be refractory to conventional treatment. We very commonly see these seizures with isoniazid overdoses. In addition to seizures, these patients will also have a metabolic acidosis and coma. Pyridoxine is an antidote. It's an antidote for isoniazid-induced seizures, and it also corrects the metabolic acidosis, and it can reverse the coma. So it's a really good antidote for those overdoses. The dose of pyridoxine is equal to the dose of isoniazid that the patient ingested in the acute overdose. Now, a lot of times we don't know that, so if the dose isn't known, what we usually do is just give a dose of 5 grams of the pyridoxine. Theophylline is a drug that's used for bronchoconstriction in asthma. It's also a stimulant with seizures occurring following acute and chronic overdoses. And years ago, we used to see a lot of seizures, a lot of overdoses with theophylline. The incidence of seizures caused by theophylline has really decreased over the years because we now have newer, safer drugs that are more commonly being used for these medical conditions. Once again, the seizures from theophylline are sometimes refractory to conventional anticonvulsant therapy, so they might be quite difficult to treat. Diphenhydramine or Benadryl, and at times other antihistamines, can induce seizures and overdoses. The seizures are usually brief. They're usually accompanied by anticholinergic effects, effects such as dry mouth and skin, flushing, dilated pupils, tachycardia, and hypertension. So these are just some of the many drugs that can cause seizures. When searching for a cause for a patient's seizures, you need to keep in mind that there are also toxins other than drugs that can be the source. There can be toxins such as strychnine, carbon monoxide, camphor, cyanide, pesticides, heavy metals such as lead and arsenic, and also some plant and herbal toxins as well can cause seizures. The treatment for drug-induced seizures is really not very different than that from other causes. There should be rapid attention to the ABCs, attempts to bring the seizures under control, and by bringing the seizures under control, you're going to prevent complications like hyperthermia or hypoxia. What we generally recommend are benzodiazepines, such as diazepam, lorazepam, midazolam. They're the preferred agents for controlling drug-induced seizures. Phenytoin or Dilantin is usually the second-line drug for seizures of other causes, but it really is not very effective for drug-induced seizures. So there's a little bit of difference when we talk about treatment of seizures. So if we need a second-line agent, we usually jump to phenobarbital as the second choice. The outcome of the patient depends on where they had the seizure, whether they've been hypoxic, how many seizures they had, whether they aspirated, and also what other effects from the drug are present, because there can be some pretty serious other toxic effects related to the drug overdose, maybe cardiovascular or respiratory in nature. One last note, a lot of these patients, they are drug overdoses, and so we need to consider about whether activated charcoal might be indicated to bind the the drug, so some of the drug does not get absorbed into the systemic circulation. Although it can be useful in binding the drug, there is a risk of aspiration should the patient start seizing soon after being given the charcoal. So you have to keep that in mind and in consideration when deciding whether to give activated charcoal or not.
That's great, Lisa. And I'll tell you, it always helps to call your poison control center. And you want to remind us of that number again real quick?
Absolutely. Definitely call the poison center. We can help to diagnose these patients. For example, we receive a lot of calls at our center about patients where they suspect an overdose and they are seizing, and the physician or the EMS provider calls us and wants to know what it could be. And the first thing, again, we think of is bupropion, and a lot of times that's what it turns out to be. And so we can let you know what other types of signs and symptoms you need to look out for. So it's important to call the poison center as soon as possible, and the number is 1-800-222-1222.
Thanks a lot, Lisa. We'll look forward to hearing from you again next month. I want to thank Lisa for contributing her efforts to the show and these Tox Tidbit segments. If you have any questions or want more information about toxicology or poison centers, you can check out the local poison center in your community. You can also just check out the Maryland Poison Center site at mdpoison.com and sign up for the Tox Tidbits email newsletter while you're there. Check it out. You don't have to live in Maryland to get access to this great resource. You can get access to it from wherever you are, and I urge you to do so. It's a great resource for your facility. You can hang it up on a training board or on an information bulletin board, and it's a great one-page thing that somebody can just stop and look at real quickly each month. So you want to check that out. That's the Tox Tidbits email newsletter available from Maryland Poison Center at mdpoison.com. And that's going to wrap up this episode of the MedicCast. I want to remind you to head over to MedicCast.com. You'll find links to the MedicCast Nursing Show, MedicCast News Podcasts, all available over there. And follow those links to get the information from the show notes and the other articles and research information that gets put up throughout the course of each week. Visit the MedicCast early and often, and schedule some time for yourself to follow up on the extra information we provide for you there. I also want to remind you, the MedicCast is a proud member of the ProMed Network. ProMedNetwork.com is a great resource for you where you can find excellent medical media just for you. If you want to get in touch with me, you can call me on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Call me up when you're listening to the show, put it in your voicemail on your phone or whatever, and you can go ahead and call me when you have a question or a problem with something. That way we can make sure you have the best information and get your voice heard here on the show. You can also email me, send your emails in to podmedic@mac.com, and we'll get back to you right away. We'll finish up with some PodSafe music. Again, this week from Ingrid Michaelson, a song, I think we've played this before. We may have even played it very recently. It's a song called Be OK from Ingrid Michaelson. If you like what you hear, head over and check out the link in the show notes and let her know you heard it here on the MedicCast. As always, you can click the iTunes button there if you'd like and purchase her songs directly from iTunes, all available easy for you to get to right from the show notes. So without further ado, here's Ingrid Michaelson with Be OK. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. And remember, folks, we all need to keep in mind scene safety and BSI. Open me up and you
just want to know today, know today, know today, know that maybe I will be okay. Open me up and you will see. I'm a gallery of broken hearts. I'm beyond repair, let me be. And give me back my broken parts. Just give me back my pieces. Just give them back to me, please. Just give me back my pieces. And let me hold my broken parts. I just wanna be okay, be okay, be okay. I just wanna be okay today. I just wanna be okay, be okay, be okay. I just wanna be okay today.